Still talking a bit about this relationship, Kate, maybe you can help us a bit. Especially, let's look at a theatre image, okay? There's a famous image of the threatened child in the Caucasian chalk circle. Grusha, the servant woman, is actually handed by these upper-class escaping people this baby, and she affirms her humanity by looking after it. What happens in Bond, as you know, that as he rewrites that image, apparently humanity is reasserted by not acting like that. Can you explain a bit?
Yeah, I hope I can. I agree with what you said, that without Brecht we wouldn't have Bond, but I fundamentally disagree about the parallels. I think they're going in absolute opposite directions. Bond says, you know, we don't move in the same direction, Brecht and I, we collide. And he calls alienation the theatre of Auschwitz, and I think that's a statement that just can't be ignored. It's far too provocative and inflammatory, and it has to be explored. What I'd like to do is sort of deconstruct one of Bond's stage images. Mm. And it's not from one of the plays, it's from his theoretical book, The Hidden Plot. And in it, he sets up this scenario where somebody is standing on a street corner, they've taken a cigarette, the last one in the packet, they've lit it, they've thrown the empty packet away, they're standing smoking it, they're shot or injured in some way, they fall to the floor dying. As they fall to the floor, the cigarette goes out, but it remains in their lips. On the stage, we have two discourses. a dying man and an empty packet of fags, okay? And this is the setting up of the TE here. Now, what do you expect? You expect Christian morality, that the person who enters the stage will value the tragic discourse, will go to the dying man and tend to him as Grusha goes to the baby and tends to it, and ignore the piece of trivia, the empty cigarette packet, the piece of rubbish. And this is where Bond is, I think, a genius, because he swaps the values of the discourses. Now, instead of valuing the dying man, the person who enters the stage steps over the dying man, picks up the cigarette packet, shakes it. So he values the rubbish and he rubbishes the humanity, the dying person. This is a really interesting sort of juxtaposition, switching around of our value systems. It's exactly what Brecht does. So far, I agree with you.
It's a kind of mainstay of English humour, isn't it? What Oscar Wilde does
it
all the time.
It creates bathos because you've got tragedy and trivia side by side, and it's very funny. It's where the black comedy comes from. But this isn't the theatre event. The theatre event is what happens next. The living person has shook the cigarettes, found they're empty, chucked them to one side, looked about, seen the fag end in the lips of the dying man, taken it, and shot the dying man, put the cigarette into his mouth, lit it, inhales, and sighs. And the TE, the theatre event, says Bond, is in the sigh. Now, what's happening here? The two discourses which have been so split, the tragic and the trivial, previously come together in an amazing way in that fag end. So that you've got a piece of rubbish, fiscally worth nothing, so valueless as it would be invisible if you saw it blowing down the street, has suddenly become invested with the value of a human life. And this is what Bond does that no other playwright does. Because the two discourses go into the cigarette. Bond calls this process cathexis, which is a Greek word. It comes from psychoanalysis, it comes from Freud. It's the idea of investing an object with human value. when he smokes the fag end that has been invested with the value of a human life, the sigh that the man gives and the smoke that comes out of his mouth is redolent of Auschwitz. Because when you step over a dying person to pick up a cigarette, you are in Auschwitz. I mean, you are also in post-modernity, where those two discourses are separated one from the other. So
I think you, in directing Red, Black and Ignorant, Peter, you've also come across these kind of theatre events. Could you give us an example?
Yeah, I will, and I'll refer to my notes if that's okay, and you'll kick me, Alex, if I go on too long. But there's in Red, Black and Ignorant, which is a play from the mid-1980s, which eventually became part of a trilogy called The War Plays. It's a post-nuclear Holocaust world, and we're taken through an episodic structure of nine scenes by a character called Monster. The monster is in fact a human being who has been destroyed in his mother's womb at the impact of the nuclear explosion. In the penultimate scene of the play, the monster, who is now married and who has a son, the son has joined the army, and there is a most incredible, powerful moment, a theatre event in which we see the mother helping to prepare the son to go and kill innocent civilians. Why? Because he's been instructed by his superiors to return to his home district and kill a civilian, or civicorps, as the non-military are contemptuously named. This is in order to quell armed unrest and opposition to the ruling powers of an oppressive totalitarian state. Within this nightmarish world, the ideological expectation is that the son will visit the home of nearby elderly neighbours who he has known from childhood and kill either the husband or his wife. The ideological imperative of the state must be fulfilled by those who, like the son, have internalised and acquiesced with that ideological apparatus of violence as moral order. However, when he gets to their home and sees these two old people, he cannot bring himself to kill them. He articulates a dialectical crisis of choice. And so he returns home and shoots his father. Prior to the son leaving his parents to visit the neighbours, the mother has helped to rearrange and smarten his army uniform, engaging in a sort of complex complicity of mothering him, but whilst with dark and tragic irony, helping prepare him for state-sanctioned murder. But the father rises after he has been killed and celebrates this moment and says, "My son has made a choice. He has, in a world that is immoral, not innately so, but because of the systems of power that use violence to enhance and support inequality, and which requires the killing of innocent people on that basis alone, the son has made a choice. There is a moment in which he has made a choice, and the choice is that it is better to kill the father than to kill the innocent."
Great. Okay. Chris, as we mentioned before, Bond now works a lot with young people, sometimes amateur theatre groups and so on. Why do you think he does that? What's his project in these kind of last 15 years?
I think it relates as well to what Mark was saying about an audience as well, about finding his audience, because I said initially that I think his plays are about us. They really are about the audience, and I think he has immense respect for his audience, whoever it may be. And I think the thing about young people, I think he once said something like, young people think of the future in the way that grown-ups think about the past. And I think that's precisely why he's interested in young people. And he recognises the need to problematise our experience dramatically, because the whole of the human psyche, the whole of our imagination, is the need to dramatise our experience in order to come to know ourselves and take responsibility for ourselves. So all the times in 11 Vests, for example, which, you know, is a difficult situation. It's not a play about Philip Lawrence at all, but that's the incident that sparked off his creative process. Mm. And what he wasn't interested in at any time was condemning the boy who committed the act, because he wanted to understand why. And again, the play doesn't define that. It doesn't give an ultimate solution. But what it does do is it continually opens up the situation to the audience for them to put themselves in there and say, well, actually, how do I measure myself in relation to the action of that person at this moment? What does that say about me? I don't think you can do a more productive thing with young people. Under any circumstances, and I think that the plays that he's writing for us, it's quite extraordinary, really. It's like this great undiscovered thing, you know. I just wish people would see the plays for themselves, but not only that, would actually see how young people engage with the problems that he presents, particularly through Theatre Event. The Balancing Act is an extraordinary piece of theatre that begins with a young girl who's locked herself in a room in a derelict house in the dark, and she's watching a spot on the floor, and what she says is that she's watching the balancing point of the world, and if anyone was to touch or disturb it, the world will end. And for me, he's just opening up both the social and the psychical within a young person to enter into that space, that spot. He creates that spot and he says to young people, fill it with your meaning, fill it with your life. Mm. And of course, young people care passionately about that spot. And they desperately want to take ownership of that spot and custody of it, because they want to be responsible for themselves. And if you can't be responsible for yourself, you know, you can't be responsible for each other, can you? Mm. And I think that's why he's found a real voice in this country. Mm. No, I'm not talking about anywhere else in the world. Mm. With his work with young people.
Yeah. Kate, to sort of double back just a little, you mentioned postmodernism at some point, and that's been mentioned a bit by everybody. He has a particular definition of postmodernism, doesn't he? Could you say a bit about that? It's not the textbook definition.
Yes.
It says crisps. You've written postmodernism crisps. Yes.
There is a bag of crisps in the play he was talking about in the balancing act. Thank you. And what the bag of crisps does is it sort of illustrates that we can be rational about the world, or we can be imaginative about the world. And in postmodernity, as I've said before, those two kind of ways of seeing tend to be split. We're either rational or we're imaginative. Now, in the bag of crisps, the girl, the boyfriend gives the girl a bag of crisps to keep her alive as she guards the spot on the floor. And she obviously there's something the matter with her, so he asks her what the matter is, and she explains to him, she confides in him that this is the spot, and if a grain of sand were to touch it, the world would end. And he becomes so frustrated with her that he takes the bag of crisps. Oh, and she's sort of illustrated how the world would end and what it would be like to have all these dead corpse people by spilling the crisps onto the floor. And so the crisps have become sort of corpses. And he's so sort of, you know, God, you potty, he says to her. And he picks up the crisps and puts them carefully back in the bag and twists it and puts the bag of crisps on the spot. Mm. And she thinks the world is going to end. And from there on in the play, her humanity, because she dies defending the spot when the house is demolished, is there in this bag of crisps. They become cathexed with her life, the value of her life. And then there are very funny sort of interchanges where he goes around carrying this bag of crisps as a vagrant, and various people say to him, God, I'm starving, give us a crisp. And he goes, I can't. They go, why not? And he goes, they're not mine. He goes, who are they? My girlfriend's. Well, ask her if I can have one. I can't, she's dead. Oh, well, that would be difficult. I'll die soon too if you don't give me a crisp, you know. And so you've got this tragic discourse and this trivial discourse going on all the time, and it's very funny.
Yeah, I like that, because you bring out his sort of humour as well, because otherwise it sounds as if his plays of the last 20 years were impossibly bleak.
The point is that the young people can see it either way. Mm. They can say, look, rationally, these are crisps. There isn't a human value in that bag of crisps. Or they can say, God, you know, you can't give away Viv's crisps. You know, that's all that's left of her. And he doesn't dictate to his audiences. Harold Pinter spoke on the radio last week about hating his audiences. Mm. And it occurred to me then what a contrast that is with Bond, who has the profoundest respect and doesn't dictate to his audiences, doesn't tell them what
to do. And yet at the same time, his work is quite difficult. I mean, there's actors have often said that when they perform Bond's work, I don't know if it's the case with Big Brum, but they get very little from the audience sometimes because it is very difficult and challenging work. Has that been?
No, because I think that's because they're not doing it right.
Okay.
So I think what he's offering is a whole new form of theatre through the kind of conventions that we've been discussing here, but it's also a new approach to acting. And all the old, I say old, I don't mean the old tricks that you see often when you're working with actors just don't work. That's why they don't get anything back. So you have to completely reassess yourself as an actor in order to play the plays. I mean, he doesn't talk about acting, he talks about enacting, he doesn't talk about character, he talks about sight. And all of that is something that in the process, I'm very lucky because in our company we have two or three actors who've worked through the whole process. So for us, it's been a complete deconstruction of everything we know. Stop sentimentalising, stop acting, stop washing every scene with needless emotion, and actually allow yourself to engage in the situation, which doesn't mean to say there's not a use for emotion. There is, but it has to be appropriate and it has to be directed with the correct energy in order to make the most active agent, the audience, engage with the material. Because when we work with young people, I mean, in terms of humour, I mean, you literally, in the balancing act, which at times descends into the most extreme kind of farce, you know, the kids are on the one hand are literally rolling on the floor, getting up and dancing around because they're not in the theatre. You know, if they see the foreman doing a tap dance on the table, which he does, as he's sort of tempting the spot, they're getting up and doing it too. And at the same time, they're dealing with it with great seriousness. And actually, they're able to hold both things. So I would say that if you're looking for those old kind of... If you're looking for how things work, how can I make it work, is how actors often approach a problem. And it's the wrong way to approach... Well, I think it's the wrong way to approach any play, actually. Yeah. But it is, isn't it? I'm sure you'll see it in the work in your own plays, Mark, as well. You know, how does this work? Or, well, what's my character's motivation? It's just the wrong place to start. And it's not useful. It's a complete diversion from the problem. And I think that's the challenge he sets.
That's really clear. Can we just move on just to sort of finish up a bit about talking about Bond's reputation? Mark, why do you think he's so ignored in this country while abroad there is production after production of his work?
Yeah, I mean, as soon as you travel, you know, you're aware of the disparity, but particularly in France right now, you know, Bond is given huge productions and probably is certainly the most respected of the British playwrights. If they're well played and well directed and everything, of course they're brilliant plays, but It is a different way of being as a writer and of making theatre, and those great plays they're kind of products of high modernism in a way. They're pretty austere, and when we go to the theatre in London, in the West End, and really, you know, as you've said, really the subsidised theatres are more or less now a kind of extension of the West End. They're just kind of the West End subsidised. You know, we expect theatre to offer itself up pretty readily to itself. We might want a little bit of intellectual stimulation with the History Boys or a Tom Stoppard play, a little light laugh, and you know, stuff's got to offer itself up pretty easily. And these plays, they're pretty intractable often, and they're quite kind of austere and stony. And I think because there's a whole different attitude in the rest of Europe as to what art is, and that it's and the night at the theatre isn't something that's going to be slipped down very easily before you go to supper. That you know, that Bond actually works within that context, that idea of what theatre and a work of art is, and it doesn't sit alongside Tom Stoppard and Alan Bennett.
It's really quite awful, isn't it? I mean, here is one of the foremost British writers of the past 50 years, and his work is simply not being staged, either by subsidised or commercial theatres very often. Peter, what's your take on this?
Well, just to support what Mark has said, really, but and there's also the bigger picture, isn't there, of at this moment in history, a kind of a demise of the credibility of a certain kind of political debate or a certain kind of political ideology, which, if you take that bigger picture out of the equation, it creates an additional problem. I mean, Bond is the second most produced playwright in France, but he said in a letter to me dated about 12 months ago, he said, "It's as if I write my plays for a piano, but they're performed on a triangle." But he also very generously says, "This is not anyone's fault. We have lost the sense of that site, that ontological site, that foundational site on which drama happens and how it speaks to us now." And I think it's almost like, therefore, Bond writing in a language which simply seems to be indecipherable, seems to be unintelligible, in this kind of, you know, soundbite-soaked, ideology-free, Blairite culture, where Sir Richard Eyre blithely compares the character of Mary Poppins with Hedda Gabler, one of the great characters of dramatic realism. So I think, you know, it's a desert.
Right.
It's a desert.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I couldn't agree more. It's. I mean, I'm speaking as someone who tries to go to the theatre sometimes. It's just so boring. I think we have a real crisis of culture. And because of the way that theatres... You know, I mean, you'd get indigestion, wouldn't you, going to an Edward play, you know, and fitting it round your lunch in the West End or whatever, and good. It should, because, you know, there's nothing worse than the complacency of the well-fed. And I think that's the problem with the theatre that we have in this country. It's so difficult for people with imagination, with something really important to say, to get their work put on. The risks are too great. I mean, there's a very important incident in Birmingham only a few months ago with the having to take the player Beshti off. That's such a crisis. And should be treated as such. And I think it is everything to do with how we view art and how we view the role of our work in society that's up for grabs. And it really is a desert. And it really denigrates us all, I think.